Good afternoon, and welcome to Reminiscing, a program of nostalgia and recollections of the good old days, times that we remember as happy and maybe a little simpler. We know we can't go back, but we can certainly reminisce. This is your volunteer reader, Mary Ellen Stepanek, and you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, your 24-hour reading station. Today, we'll see if we can finish the articles in the April issue of the Good Old Days magazine. This one is entitled, Remembering the Toys We Made. Rather than purchasing toys at the dime store, this family created their own, using whatever was at hand. This was written by Arlene Schovald. We didn't have a lot of money to buy toys when I was growing up in Iron River, Michigan, in the 1940s and 50s. Besides, the only local store that had toys was the J.J. Newberry Dime Store on Genesee Street in Iron River's downtown area. We lived in the country and didn't get to town often, so my older cousin Ronnie and I, along with other neighborhood kids, sometimes built our own toys. One handmade toy I remember was our telephone system. Ronnie and I used two clean Campbell soup cans with a string attached to each of the cans to communicate across the distance, and it actually worked, provided we kept the string taut. Ronnie lived just up the hill from my house, about 100 feet away, and we could have more easily shouted to each other, but making the telephones was more fun and a challenge. Besides, we were very proud of our success. We made another means of communication using Hershey cocoa cans, which were made of metal in those days. We made mailboxes out of the cocoa cans and deposited notes to each other in them. Building shacks in the woods was fun, until it rained. We used cardboard boxes and whatever building materials we could scrounge up. Occasionally, we would come across a scrap of tin or an abandoned board. We were pretty proud of our creation, until the inevitable rain hit and the cardboard shack decayed into a soggy brown mess. Another pastime, our homemade horse, is kind of difficult to describe. Like most kids, my friends and I wanted a horse, but we couldn't have one, so we made our own. Our dads had wooden sawhorses, the old-fashioned kind that they might have even made themselves. We used the sawhorses to make a pretend horse and used an old blanket for a saddle. We placed a long wooden board between the two front legs of one sawhorse and over the top of a second sawhorse. Then we took turns riding the first sawhorse, with one or two kids moving the board up and down over the second sawhorse, kind of like a teeter-totter, causing the first sawhorse to gallop. Needless to say, a few slivers resulted from riding that wooden steed, but we sure had a good time. We also made kites from newspapers with skinny sticks or branches forming the frame. The kite tail was made of rags from our mother's rag bags, which were in every house in those days. Anything made of fabric that wore out was saved in the rag bag to be used for dishcloths or dust rags. Sometimes the kites we made actually flew, but most of the time we just got a lot of exercise as we ran, pulling the kite behind us while trying to get it off the ground. In the winter, we made tents inside the house by covering a card table with a blanket. We often did that until we got too big to fit in the tent. Sometimes my dad helped create some of this handmade fun. He once made a merry-go-round from an old wooden wagon wheel. There were still a few of them around back in the 1940s, and he managed to mount the wagon wheel, which measured about 4 feet across, onto a base that turned. That merry-go-round was enjoyed by all the neighborhood kids. When Ronnie was about 12, he and the older neighborhood boys built a treehouse with a ladder of sticks nailed to the tree to gain entrance. Somehow, they managed to get my 3-year-old brother in the treehouse. When they couldn't get him down, my dad had to come to the rescue. Apparently, the boys were pretty good carpenters because the ladder they made up the side of the tree held my dad's weight. Dad was able to climb up, put my little brother on his shoulders, and get safely back down to the ground without a catastrophe. My dad also built a playhouse for me, and there was no limit to my imagination for what that playhouse could be. Sometimes it was a place for playing house, but other times it became a bunkhouse for the ranch, as we pretended to be characters from Bobby Benson and the B-Bar-B Riders, which was a radio show we listened to. Other times, the playhouse was headquarters for a circus, an airplane which I piloted using a round ashtray on a stand for a steering wheel, a newspaper office, and even a swap shop after I read a book about a teenage sleuth and a swap shop mystery. J.J. Newberry didn't make much money on toys from the families in my neighborhood, but we probably had more fun with our makeshift toys than anyone did with the store-bought ones. And this story was entitled Remembering the Toys We Made by Arlene Schovald. This next story is entitled The Landlord Buys and We Paint. The agreement meant freshly painted buildings, but also a lot of work. And this story was by Susan Davis. In 1957, we moved to Dad's boyhood farm, located in northeastern Colorado. The small farm had previously been rented and farmed by his father. The same landlord owned it when we lived there. When it came to the upkeep of the house, Mom made a fairly good deal with our landlord. She told him, "If you buy the paint, we'll do the work." When it came time to put the main coat on the outside of the house, Mom generally stayed indoors and did her housework. I was 11 at the time. My sister's brother and I got the job of slapping on the white paint. It was usually up to my older sister to climb the ladder and paint the eaves. If I remember correctly, one of us also stood on a 55-gallon barrel to reach the boards as high as he or she could. The first morning, it was fun to do something different. I was anything but a good painter. I couldn't help but dip my big brush too far into the can. Lots of the oil-based paint splattered on the ground and all over me. I soon had my paintbrush so saturated that it didn't want to glide easily over the white boards. When it was noon, we cleaned up. We soaked our brushes in a can filled with gasoline. I recall rubbing my arms with gas to remove the splotches of white paint from my sunburned skin. It did a good job of cleaning, but even after washing with hot, soapy water, some of the gas smell remained on me. I don't think we painted in the afternoons. We probably had other work to do around the farm, and the summer sun was too hot for painting. Painting the house seemed like a monumental task. I had to admit, the clean, bright white finish looked so much better than the old weather-beaten white exterior. The thirsty wood had soaked up gallon after gallon of paint. Fortunately for us, we didn't have to paint the north and west sides of the house because asbestos shingles covered them. After we were done painting, Mom painted the trim dark green. Unfortunately for my siblings and me, we had some leftover white paint. Mom informed us that we would be painting the pump house next. She said that it definitely needed a refresh, too. There was one consolation. The pump house had a lot less area to cover than our house had. We finished that job fairly quickly, but Mom didn't let us put away our brushes yet. She told us we could use up the remaining paint on the eaves of our small barn. It was a good thing that the rest of the barn was constructed from corrugated metal. As we tackled our barn job, we complained about how tired of painting we were. We stood on the truck box to reach the weathered boards. We sure were happy when the last gallon of paint was empty. When Mom felt like a room of the house needed repainting, she again asked the landlord for the materials. In this case, she was able to choose the colors she wanted. The landlord told her to pick it up at the store and to charge the bill to him. Mom did all the indoor painting. She probably didn't want her kids making a drippy mess on her linoleum floors. I remember the time Mom chose a green color for the kitchen. She started painting in the corner by the stove. She soon caught our attention when she burst out loud, saying, "It's green as grass." She was right. It was downright ugly. Mom thought for a moment about finishing with the color she had mistakenly chosen. She didn't want to ask the landlord for more paint. We talked her into going back to the store to see what they could do. She wasn't in the best of moods. She probably felt like a farmer ready to harvest when, as soon as he pulled into the field, his tractor broke down. Mom changed out of her old clothes and got dressed for going into town. When she got back home, she was happier. She didn't have to buy any more paint. She told us they just added a little white to the green. Everyone watched as Mom applied the new, much more mellow shade of green on the kitchen wall. We liked the color. It was amazing how that little bit of white paint went a long way in curing her dilemma. In all the years we lived on that rented farm, the paint policy worked well. Whenever we needed exterior or interior paint, the landlord furnished the materials and we provided the labor to keep the farmhouse and outbuildings in good condition. And this story was entitled "The Landlord Buys and We Paint" by Susan Davis. Now here's a story entitled "Blowing in the Wind." There were unwritten rules for a successful laundry day. This was written and sent in by Ken Newser. 10 of us children, including 7 boys born consecutively, meant lots of laundry, heaps of it. Plus, back in the 1940s and located in the bustling shipbuilding center of Manitowoc, Wisconsin, sleeping quarters were a precious commodity. Three of the bedrooms in our large framed house were rented out, and those monies were paid to the dentist for what Mother described as million-dollar smiles, a trade-off for laundering yet more piles of pillowcases and bedding. Doing laundry is one of the oldest domestic tasks, and at our house, it was done several times a week. Preparation began the prior evening, gathering and sorting the work for the following day. Light color clothing in one pile, dark clothing in a second. Water had to be poured into the copper boiler positioned on the gas plate, ready to be lit the following morning. There were no convenient laundry rooms on the first floor in that era. The damp basement was the nucleus of laundry labor. And there were endless tasks. Bluing had to be added to enhance the whites, and some were soaked overnight for additional cleansing. The wash stick, a former broom handle, was kept in the corner until it was needed to pre-treat the thrashing that was to occur in the house. They were made of galvanized pipes from my dad's workshop. Skilled in the plumbing trade, Dad knew the importance of placing wash poles in cement, and he possessed the foresight to weld the hooks for the pending weight of the wet, heavy loads. The poles were painted silver, creating the image of a guarded patrol. Plastic-coated clotheslines for outdoor laundry were a great invention, doing away with the necessity of stringing lines each time the wash was brought outside to dry. Plastic coating, however, meant wiping those lines before service, a perfect job for those of us 10 children who were able to reach the proper height. One of the highest compliments attributed to a housekeeper was, "She did a good wash," and that started with a clean clothesline. Meanwhile, up the 10 basement steps came the results of the tub room. Anchored above the steps was a shelf lined with empty blue mason jars, reminders to be taken down the steps to the basement fruit cellar when hands allowed extra baggage. A fruit crate used for berry picking held the wooden clothespins. There were two kinds, the traditional one-piece construction with its knob top, and then the snapper type, with a wire spring, which was prone to rusting from the wet laundry. Regardless, there never seemed to be a sufficient supply, the challenge being to line up the clothing to allow one pin to hold two pieces of washed goods. Mother ruled the line. Sheets and pillowcases had to be hung on the outer lines, providing privacy for underwear and cleaning rags on the interior. We took turns helping, holding up the next piece to be hung, saving the mistress of laundry some of the endless bending to retrieve the next of the infinite goods. Those of us who were taller opted for the bigger trappings, keeping in mind the hanging rules: socks by the toes, shirts by the shoulders, trousers or jeans by the then-fashionable cuffs. Well-hung clotheslines relayed messages in this era before emailing and texting. Disarrayed, dingy laundry also told a lot. Diapers spoke of a new baby in the house. A fancy tablecloth meant company. Extra sheets, nightclothes, and perhaps a bathrobe relayed illness had struck the household. The goal was to have the laundry dried and removed from the lines before lunch. Then would begin Mother's labor of ironing. Back in the 1940s, cotton fabric reigned. Items not ironed by late afternoon were sprinkled with water, rolled up, and placed in the refrigerator, looking like sausages in the butcher shop. Clothespins were never left on the line. Their removal was yet another childhood task. Bare lines meant the task was finally done. Basic human needs have not changed. Technology has changed the business of doing laundry, but give me breezes, gentle winds, and laundry on the clothesline. This was Blowing in the Wind by Ken Newser. Our final story is entitled Playing in Yesteryear, sent in by Linda Vandiver. When I was a child, we used our imaginations to make our own fun. Let me take you back to the 1950s, when I was between the ages of 5 and 10, and tell you how we used to play when there were no computers or video games. I don't think the kids in my hometown of Madisonville, Kentucky, were any different from kids in any other part of our nation. We all made up our own fun. First of all, we made our own version of stilts. There was no going to the sports or toy store to buy brightly decorated poles with secure footrests. Oh, no. We made our own stilts. We found empty, discarded motor oil cans from the corner gas station, the kind with two V cuts made in the tops for pouring out the oil. One of our dads or moms would thread a long, narrow piece of strong twine or rope through the openings and then tie the ends into a tight knot. Then we kids would put a foot on the top of each can, and holding on to the ropes, we'd walk up and down the sidewalk or have races. Supper time would find us going home with dented stilts and a few skinned knees and elbows. Spring was the time when people in the neighborhood would spruce up and spring clean their homes, with at least one family buying a new piece of furniture or an appliance, which would arrive in a huge cardboard box. It was playtime again. The neighborhood kids would ask for the big brown box, and one of the parents would cut out doors and windows, leaving the cutouts attached on one side so we could open and close them. One kid would take a turn at pretending to live in the cardboard house, and the rest of us would come to knock on the door or talk through the windows to the one inside. My mother saved junk mail. We didn't receive as much back then as there is now. And we'd play post office with it, delivering the mail to each house in the neighborhood. My mother also saved empty Band-Aid boxes, Alka-Seltzer tubes, metal aspirin boxes, and such, so we kids could play nurse with our dolls. A trip to a real zoo was a once-in-a-lifetime event for us, so we made our own jar zoo at home. Our mothers would save and clean jars that formerly held mayonnaise, mustard, pickles, jams, and so forth. Then we kids would catch butterflies, beetles, snails, grasshoppers, ants, bees, worms, ladybugs, and caterpillars. If we were lucky, we had some more exotic animals like a corn worm that had been found when someone was shucking corn, or a praying mantis that one of the braver boys had plucked from a bush. We'd put these little creatures in the clean jars with a little grass and water and screw on the metal lids that had holes poked in them by someone's dad or mom using an ice pick or a screwdriver. After we'd collected all our zoo animals, we'd line up the jars on someone's front porch steps, and then we'd tell our moms, dads, and all our neighbors about the zoo. We charged folks and other kids a penny to see our zoo. An afternoon's take would finance a trip to Mr. Harkin's store to buy penny candy from the rows of canisters sitting on the counter. What a wonderful way to end a summer day. We enjoyed the fruits of our labor, which tasted like peppermint, orange slices, chocolate, and lemon drops. World or space travel was nothing compared to the places created by the imaginations of children spending a morning or afternoon beneath a big weeping willow tree, whose flowing branches met the ground to create a screen between them and the outside world. Beneath that cool, shadowed covering, we would be transported to the surface of the moon or to a deserted tropical island where we imagined struggling to survive, eating crumbled cookies and drinking water or Kool-Aid from our tea set as we protected our baby dolls from the unknown dangers lurking just beyond those green leaves. At twilight, our moms or dads calling us home for supper was the only thing that moved us from our self-made domain. Kids and teens who want the name brand and popular dress items of today had nothing on us when we played dress-up. Pulling boxes, sacks, and trunks of old stored clothes into the backyard meant a day spent trying on all sorts of things, dresses, blouses, skirts, jeans, coats, coveralls, uniforms, boas, muffs, jewelry, aprons, party dresses, old formals, shirts, scarves, pants, jackets, hats, and shawls. There were all sorts of characters waiting to come to life in those containers. A queen, a schoolteacher, a gypsy, a peasant girl, a movie star, a cowboy, an Indian, a soldier, and even a pirate. The cast of characters created was limited only by the imagination of the child. No one said, "There's nothing to do," or "I'm bored," back in those days. We didn't want to be entertained. We made our own activities and entertainment, and those memories became some of the favorite parts of looking back on my wonderful childhood days. And this was Playing in Yesteryear by Linda Vandiver. Here's a little item under Flashback Fun. It says, artificial turf came to public attention in 1966 after it was installed in the Astrodome in Houston, where it was labeled AstroTurf. Well, you've been listening to Reminiscing on Sun Sounds of Arizona, Arizona's 24-hour reading station. This is your volunteer reader, Dr. Mary Ellen Stepanek, wishing you good afternoon and good memories.